Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Why Bitcoin Podcast coming again this week on the show. I'm joined with Julian Figueroa.
Figueroa.
I that was what I meant to ask right before we started recording. You know how I was asking those questions?
Like, yeah, the way I explain it, it's a Peruvian last name. It's like the opera Figaro, and then you just add an A at the end. So like Figueroa.
Very nice. Very cool. Let's, you know what, dude? You're out here with your full name. When did you decide to fully dox yourself to become a Bitcoin content creator? Did you think about staying anon for a while, or did you just figure, I've never,
you know, and that's a really interesting way to start this off, because if there's one aspect about Bitcoin that I don't think in my learning journey I've fully come to appreciate, it is privacy and its anonymity and the importance of that. I've always been a very public person in all kind of facets of my life. I haven't really used, you know, I have like usernames for, you know, when I go online and I play video games and stuff, but I've always been pretty public with, you know, my name and everything like that. It's my real name. Part of the reason I haven't really been too worried about it in terms of like privacy is actually I am one of thousands of Julian Figueroas out there. And if you look up my name, you won't find me. There is a famous Mexican singer that unfortunately died this year named Julian Figueroa. And whenever I traveled to Mexico and they looked at my ID, they were like, oh, are you that Julian Figueroa? And I'm like, nope, I'm not. So yeah, I've had an interesting relationship, I guess, with, you know, just being, I guess, more public about my name. And it's kind of interesting when you come to the Bitcoin world, how people really value keeping it private all the way up the ranks of some of the, you know, the biggest names and the biggest creators in this space, like obviously Satoshi. But you have a lot of people who are running companies that don't really release their public names. They're CEOs of these companies that have hundreds of employees working under them, and they might not have a single employee actually know what their real name is. So yeah, it's kind of interesting, isn't it?
It is really cool. I'm kind of half doc. Like if people wanted to figure out who I was and where I lived, I'm sure they could, but I'd still try and keep it on the down low. Just cause I mean, the reason, okay, we'll get into this. The reason I started my podcast was because I just wanted to talk to Bitcoiners because I was fascinated by Bitcoin, and I figured Bitcoiners are the smartest people on the planet. So I'm going to try and talk to as many of them as I can, because somehow I snuck in here and I'm going to pretend like I'm smart by talking to smarter people. That was my motivation. What was your motivation towards just starting? Actually, you know what? This is what I really want to know. Before you found Bitcoin, did you want to be a YouTuber of sorts? And then Bitcoin came and you're like, this is what my topic is going to be? Or was it you found Bitcoin and then you decided you wanted to start creating content for the internet?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've always been into filmmaking and storytelling. I actually, when I was really young, I wanted to make video games, and I actually spent a long time. Do you know a website called Newgrounds.com? Do you ever remember like Flash games, all that stuff?
Yeah, dude. Definitely seen Newgrounds. That's where I saw my first boobs, I think.
There we go. Yeah, all those like Flash cartoons, albino black sheep, all that stuff.
Absolutely.
I really wanted to be an animator and game designer when I was younger, and I got really involved in those communities, man, when I was like 9, 10 years old, and I was making like Flash cartoons and Flash games, and it had something very similar to this sort of like cypherpunk vibe that the Bitcoin community has. It was a lot of people in the early internet age making their own media and content that was just way too risque to ever see on mainstream networks. And then obviously like Adult Swim caught up with it. Adult Swim hosts a ton of shows that were made by former Newgrounds animators. So I got into that realm and I really wanted to do that for a living for the longest time. But the problem I found was it was just so competitive, and I just, you know, never was like the most amazing artist. So I graduated from that kind of like animation and game design field into more filmmaking. And I made short films. I made a feature film when I was in high school, and I went to university to study film. The initial plan was to work in the film industry, work in Hollywood, make TV shows, movies, or whatever. But it's sort of one of these industries where you just always have to know and schmooze with someone. And that's just not quite a personality match for me. So I ended up going more into the realm of video production, doing commercials and corporate videos and working with CEOs. And I really found my footing with editing. So I really loved putting together stories from, you know, just the footage I was offered. It always kind of reminded me of playing with Lego. You kind of have this like bucket and you have to make something out of it. And that evolved into me finally saying, I'm tired of making videos for other people's, you know, visions, and I want to make something for myself. And the impetus to start creating Bitcoin content was I had my first Bitcoin investments and all that stuff, a lot of it in Quadriga, and I got rug pulled, and everyone got rug pulled with that. I learned about not your keys, not your coins. And the way that I recovered from that, because it was a very significant financial loss at the time, was I made a YouTube video about it. I said, okay, why don't I just try some public speaking, put a little bit of like my filmmaking creativity into it, and maybe, you know, just talking about it and seeing how other people react, and maybe finding some other people who are in the same boat that could help me get over the situation I was in, feeling so miserable with that. And sure enough, it did. And I had other people ask me, oh, you should make a video about this and that. And I did a lot of different videos. I was still into general crypto at the time. But yeah, it sort of started my Bitcoin content creation journey, sort of started as like therapy. And then it evolved into finding out what people wanted and a good crossover of what audiences wanted and what I wanted to make as a creator. And yeah, here I am today, still making this stuff.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I don't think... Okay, so you were in the Quadriga collapse. I feel like the Quadriga thing, like I did a lot of researching the history of Bitcoin when I first got in. Obviously, Gox is like a major story in everybody's memory. If you do, and if you look back at what the history of Bitcoin is at all, Mt. Gox is a shining light there. But Quadriga, I feel like it isn't talked about as much as other things. Can you just kind of give me a little like Cliff's Notes idea of exactly what happened there? Was it the same thing? You know, you just had money on exchange went bust, or was there more to it? How did that affect you personally?
Well, I think a Quadriga wasn't talked about as much because it was basically a Canadian only story. I don't think there were any other people involved besides just Canadians. It was the biggest exchange in Canada for a while. And what had essentially happened is that it was run in the first few years as like an honest attempt to do a good exchange. And then the founder and kind of the owner of the whole thing, Gerald Cotton, ended up basically using it as like a fractional reserve bank for his own trading. And then mysteriously in the end of 2018, it was announced that he passed away from like a complication with Crohn's, while he was in India building an orphanage. And I mean, that sentence right there just raises a ton of red flags. And so, you know, he passes away, his widow, you know, delivers this story. Apparently he was the only key holder to all the Bitcoin. Then it turns out none of that Bitcoin's actually there. It was all fractionally reserved, lent out, and there was only a fraction remaining. And there's a lot of intrigue to that story, and they have made a few documentaries about it, but it was all kind of just dead ends. There's a lot of theories as to what happened with him for real. You can believe what you're told about it, which is that he actually died of this disease. Some people think that he was assassinated. Some people think that he's still running around under a different ID, got some plastic surgery done, and he's living the high life. No one really knows. It's really hard to verify. They never exhumed the body, so there is no evidence of his body anywhere. So yeah, but it was a really intriguing story, and it's like a really good jumping off point. I mean, you hear all this and you realize, oh my God, like this guy was in charge of this exchange and all the money. And then you realize a whole bunch of other things, like, oh, the support I was talking to was really just him the whole time. And they were using, you know, monikers, to pretend that they had a much bigger team than they really did. And yeah, it was, I think that experience kind of opened my door to how interesting the whole world of Bitcoin was too, because I had held Bitcoin for a few years up to that point. And, you know, I went through things like the Bitcoin Cash fork, and there's some drama there, but nothing was quite as crazy up until that point, at least from my perspective, as that story, just the human intrigue of it all and all the people affected. I guess Mt. Gox was second to it, but that was, you know, overseas, and there was a lawsuit, and it was a bit more tangible. This was just so many questions raised. And the more that you dug into the Quadriga story, just like the more questions you had. So, yeah.
It's so wild. Yeah, that does. I do remember that one now. It's just such a crazy world. So then, dude, I need to understand. Okay, so you're holding some Bitcoin. Quadriga was a crypto exchange, so selling other shit coins. The year is what, like 2016 something? There's probably not that many shit coins. Maybe a couple hundred, maybe a couple thousand.
Definitely. Yeah, Quadriga.
Yeah.
Quadriga only hosted Bitcoin, all the Bitcoin forks, Ethereum, and Litecoin. That was it.
Okay. So at that point, while you were on there, did you understand the difference between Bitcoin, the forks, Ethereum, Litecoin, or was it all the same to you? And then when did that shift happen for you? Or has it happened yet? I feel like do you consider yourself a Bitcoin maximalist?
Yeah. The same way that I can't tell you what orange pilling really means either. It's just like we throw these terms around and there's no clear cut definitions. But I would say that I'm a Bitcoin monetary maximalist, and I believe that I don't think any of those other coins fulfill any type of role in a monetary system. And the questions around whether they're useful even beyond that are really important too. And I don't really feel like there is a use for blockchain really outside of money. It's just a very inefficient database for just about anything else. But it took me a long time to get there in my Bitcoin journey. And I would say maybe this year I have now finally been more of what you could call a Bitcoin maximalist than I was a pre-Bitcoin maximalist. So I got into Bitcoin kind of seriously in 2016. And I would say it really wasn't until Michael Saylor came around and really elucidated kind of the big difference between what Bitcoin and crypto is that I really finally said no to Ethereum and to shitcoins. 2016 to 2020, I was huge into Ethereum and following all that stuff. And in fact, you know, this is not news if people know who I am, but I ran a video production company and animation company, and I still do. And many of the clients that we had for animations were ICOs. I would be doing videos, writing the scripts for the ICO videos that would go on to be pitched to investors and plebs and all these people. And I bought into it at the time. To me, they weren't scams. To me, they were, you know, game-changing ways to leverage decentralized technology. But it took a lot of learning, and it took a lot of kind of hammering home some of these podcasts like yours to really start to see the difference. And I think all of it was just cemented by all the mania in 21, like all the greed that came with these stupid other tokens and, you know, the scams left and right, and then Luna. And it just became so obvious that even if you don't believe the investment thesis, a lot of the people in the blockchain and the crypto space just have corrupt morals. And I didn't want to be involved in that from that standpoint even. So the Bitcoiners and being around Bitcoiners, it's good karma and it's good energy. And you start, you know, even if you buy that maybe blockchain is good for something else, you go to those conferences, you speak with a lot of those people, and the only thing on their mind is to extract as much wealth from their projects through the fiat system as much as they can. And that kind of like moral bankruptcy is what I tell people is the reason that you should avoid this stuff, because essentially you go down the same rabbit hole of people who pitch you, you know, penny stocks, like in Wolf of Wall Street. It's the same crowd of people in the NFT space and the crypto space. These are, you know, and I don't want to say all of them, but 90%+ of them are just rent seekers. And you can see it and hear it in conversations in back doors. You can see tacit admissions of it with the greed. I mean, we've all seen like BitBoy and all these stuff. These are just not people that you want to surround yourself with. These aren't people who are honest to you. They're not honest to themselves. And that's, you know, after experiencing that, that's kind of why I left all that crypto stuff behind.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. I know. This would be an interesting question for you too then. So what I like to do on occasion, I don't do it too often, Julian, but every once in a while, I'll just spark up a conversation with like random shitcoiner and try and understand where they're coming from. You know, on Twitter right now, for some reason, Nano keeps popping up in my feed. I'm like, what? Like sometimes it's name your fucking shitcoin of choice. They're all the same ones that keep popping up. So I'll see somebody that's really into, you know, whatever shitcoin, and I'll just reach out, DM them, be like, why do you like this thing? Don't you understand that it's completely pointless? And try and get into their head and understand like where they're at. And it is sad when you talk to some of these people that are so, I think you're right. I think there's people that are just out there trying to make a quick buck, like whatever, be a scammer, try and steal people's money. That's your prerogative if that's what you want to do. But it's really weird when you talk to the people that believe in the projects or think that there's something there. And I think it's because of the way they're persuaded and they don't ask the questions of why it's necessary. So my question to you is, do you ever do that, especially given your the content you're making, the videos you make? There's such a larger audience for crypto than there is for Bitcoin. So do you ever think, or do you ever consider going and talking to some of these crypto people to try and figure out where their head's at? Is that something you've tried before?
Yeah. And actually, that's an idea for a video I've kind of been exploring, you know, infiltrating crypto conferences and engaging people. I don't think that these like crypto people are beneath contempt. I'm not like Saifedean in that regard, where it's like, don't even interact with these scammers. And a lot of people, you know, of that kin think that these people basically need to repent their sins before they're worthy of talking to us Bitcoiners. To me, that's also just another form of egotism. I think if you want to engage with someone, you just engage with them. And you shouldn't have a pretense, you know, based on something that they've said. If they're willing to have an honest conversation with you and defend what they want to defend and, you know, interact with you on that level, if you're just curious about why they like crypto over Bitcoin, then interact with them. But I think, you know, trying to censor or pretend they don't exist is, you know, kind of silly. Like, and we know that, especially this cycle, like the crypto people are not going to disappear. As long as the fiat system is extracting wealth from people, there will always be a shiny new investment object that will help someone get rich quick. And there's no other platform where it's easier to deploy your own investment mechanism than through a blockchain. That, if you want to think of an innovation for blockchain, it's the ability to whip up a investable product quicker and with basically no permission. So it's going to keep happening, and we're going to get smarter, you know, as a general population at filtering out the crimes and kind of the nonsense. But that also means that all the shit coining will get more complex, and it'll disguise itself as something legit. And I think you're sort of seeing that with, you know, the BRC20 stuff. It's like, well, people understand that Bitcoin's the only legit thing, so we'll build the thing into Bitcoin, and then we can say, hey, it's got all the Bitcoin properties. It's scarce, it's uncensorable, blah, blah, blah. And it, like, there's a very clear arc to all this stuff. Like the ICO age of 2017 was, we're going to whip up our own blockchain. And then the grift of 2021 was, we're going to make art on the blockchain, and it's going to be a blockchain that you're familiar with, and it's going to be backed by that, and there's going to be a marketplace for it. That didn't work out. We're going to do the same thing again, but we're going to make it backed by Bitcoin, because we don't know which one of these, you know, 20 different blockchains is going to work out, but we do know that Bitcoin's going to be around. So it'll just keep getting more and more and more complex as audiences kind of wise up to what's really going on. But I miss your initial question. I think in terms of engaging with people on this level, I think that's an individual choice. I don't think that we should prescribe other people, you know, do or don't talk to these people. I think it's like, what do you get out of it as an individual? Do you feel like you can persuade someone? Do you really want to persuade someone to believe that Bitcoin is the only way? I mean, you have to pick your own battles, essentially.
Absolutely, man. Yeah, it's fun. I think okay, so being somebody that's been talking to people about Bitcoin for the last 3 years, so on my last show, I was talking to Frederick. Can't remember his last name off the jump. But anyways, he brought up the point that, like, everybody now, you know, in 2017, you could go up to somebody and be like, hey, have you heard about Bitcoin? And they'd be like, no, I don't know what that is. What is it? And they still have that curious mindset. Sometimes some people are already set in their ways and are against it. But now, my question for you is, so now that 2020 happened, 2021, that bull market happened, I think, at least in, you know, the West, as we call it, Canada, America, anywhere you go, anybody that's been on the fucking internet knows that Bitcoin exists, right? So everybody has an opinion, whether they're against it or they're for it or whatever. So my question to you is, like, have you noticed a change in talking to new people from where you were 3 years ago to where you are now when you're talking to, when you're bringing up the topic of Bitcoin to new people? Have you noticed a change?
I think what you bring up is a really interesting general point. And I would counter that this idea that everyone has an opinion on Bitcoin extends to almost everything. And it's very specific of just like North America and maybe Europe. Like, how many of us have gone into long diatribes about, you know, vaccine efficacy or, you know, the climate crisis, real or hoax? Like, we have to have an opinion on everything now. If you're on social media, you know, everyone has gone through Wikipedia articles or have read books, and everyone just has, you know, 100 to 500 to 1,000 words on any given topic, basically. That's not the case in most parts of the world. If I go down to Latin America and I ask people, do you think the vaccines are safe? It's like, I don't know, maybe. And you ask that question up here, they're like, well, I heard some, you know, Pfizer executives were, you know, working with the Department of Health, and everyone has these like long drawn out opinions because they spend all this time on social media and they get the little tidbits here and there and they listen to podcasts. And so everybody has a take that's usually just a derivative of someone else's take. And I think you see the same thing with Bitcoin, where essentially people's opinions are shaped on it, not from their own due diligence, from them reading a Bitcoin book, from them getting a neutral source of education on it, but because they watched a video where someone said, hey, here's a 30-minute breakdown on why this whole space is a scam. They've internalized all the knowledge from that video, and that is their opinion on Bitcoin. Or their opinion was, I bought it on Robinhood, and then I moved it to a wallet, and then I lost it. So I think it's stupid because I lost it, right? Or I listened to Warren Buffett say something, and I love Warren Buffett, and he said this about Bitcoin. So boom, that's my opinion on it. So I think people's opinions that we see on Bitcoin, when we see a lot of that negativity from, let's just call it like the no corner world, I think it's on very shaky foundations. And the easiest way to kind of like completely disrupture that foundation from at least the Bitcoiner perspective is just have the number go up. So if your perspective is, oh, this thing's old technology, blah, 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 doesn't work, nonsense, can't scale, it's like, great, the number keeps going up. What do you have to say about this? Oh, you're going to keep saying it's a scam every year, every 4 to 5 years when it adds another zero onto the end of it? It doesn't hold up forever. And I think that's when people start to question their foundation a bit, is whenever it sort of reappears in the media. But I don't think the notion that Bitcoin, everyone kind of has an opinion on it, is as widespread as people think. I think especially as someone who's traveled to South America, a lot of people have zero knowledge of it, not even heard about it on the internet, because they're just not on it as much as some of we are in the West.
That's a good point, man. Yeah, that's a really good point, that most people's opinions on most things aren't even really their opinions. I think that's one of the most annoying, infuriating things when you're talking to somebody about any given topic. It's like, what do you think about this? And you just hear that like script come back at you, and you know that they haven't really thought of it for themselves. So frustrating. Yeah, I do that a lot, and you just have to walk away and be like, oh, you don't
know. I think the problem is people are afraid to say, I don't know. Like, you listen to podcasts and you hear people speak about anything and everything, and it almost makes you feel like, oh my God, is this what the world is like? Like, everyone kind of knows a little bit about everything. And then people chase that just to kind of feel like they fit in. So everyone has to have an opinion on everything. And I think it's okay to say, I don't know, or I'm not informed enough on that. And I try and practice that in my own life. You know, maybe I'll know a little bit about something, but I have to reflect and think, wait a second, do I actually know something about this? Or am I just regurgitating two sentences I've heard on a podcast? Is it better to regurgitate those two sentences or to just say, I don't really know enough about this subject to say anything about it?
Oh yeah, man, that's a good point. I completely agree with that. I think, yeah, people have been suckered into thinking you look stupid if you don't know something. And that's one thing that I like about Bitcoiners. It seems like we're all just trying to figure it out. You know, that's what it comes down to, is when you don't know something, you got to fucking figure it out. And admit to yourself that you were wrong. Well, I guess that comes greater to an understanding of money, which you talk about a lot, right? Like, most people, when you ask them, what is money? they fucking don't know, but they'll, and okay, so this is the weird reaction you get, right? It's like they never even contemplated that question before. So at least for that idea, people are a little bit, I don't know if I have a question here, sorry, I'm just kind of thinking out loud. But when you ask somebody, what is money? Not very many people have a go-to answer for it, which is where Bitcoiners come in and like answer it, which is nice. But for the most part, so do you think there's something to what like Breedlove is saying? Instead of saying, hey, have you heard about Bitcoin? Instead say like, hey, have you thought about what money is? Is that what we should be doing more? Is that kind of what your angle is as you go forward making more videos?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this was kind of the topic of one of the videos I did. I did this video where I took a kind of kids card game called Chamery, and it teaches basically the first principles of how Bitcoin mining works, but it's designed to kind of just be this like memory card game. And part of what we did for that is we got like five kids off of Craigslist and their parents, and we sat them down and we just kind of asked them that question, what is money? And the answers that we got from the adults and the kids were so different, but you can just tell like from the adult perspective that there isn't that curiosity that is naturally found in children. But, you know, children had this idea of what money is, but they wanted to know what we thought of it as Bitcoiners or as the people kind of hosting this whole thing. And yeah, I think it's weird. And I think it's very strange, especially us in the West, how we have basically subcontracted out that question to financial advisors and to investment institutions. Like as soon as you start questioning what money is, you start questioning how you're allocating your own a lot differently. You know, what are you actually putting it into? The point of money is to, you know, hopefully if you can acquire some of it, to buy yourself some time that you would have otherwise not had. And in order to buy that time most efficiently, you have to figure out, well, what will, you know, gain value in a monetary sense that's not just cash, whether it's real estate or stocks. And people are just not curious about that. And they're like, well, I'm just going to give it to someone else and then they can figure it out. And, you know, I'll let them take a third of the profit. You know, that's totally fine by me. And that's kind of the turning point I hope to elucidate more people is like, why are we subcontracting out that core question and that core responsibility of like, what do we do with our money when it is one of the most important votes that we have on how we guide our life moving forward? You know, why are we giving so much of that power away to financial intermediaries? Why are we giving it away to people with degrees? And I think a big part of it is because the messaging for so long has been, it's too complicated for the average person to understand, right? Like, why would you want to learn about money? It's boring. It's numbers. It's quantitative easing. Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell, like BTFP program, acronyms left and right. Like, why would anybody want to follow that stuff? Just go watch the game, man. And yeah, I hope through what I do, at least, that I can open people's minds into at least thinking about it, but also make it entertaining. Like, when you go down a rabbit hole of discovering something, you have to put in work. And sometimes it does just feel like work, but sometimes it can be really fun too, because the curiosity is piqued through a medium that is entertaining or inducive to a lot of conversation. And so what I really try and do with my content is I don't want to lecture people or you know, reinvent the wheel in terms of explaining what money is to people or what Bitcoin is to people. I want to pique people's interest into what it is as a movement, what it is as a technology, make people crave the Bitcoin content and you know, really, really seek out a different world that I think we as Bitcoiners and Bitcoin represents.
Hell yeah, man. No, I appreciate what you're doing. Your shorts are unreal. I watched that Chamery video just a couple hours before we recorded this. I was going through all your shit again. Yeah, dude, speaking of making things like interesting and cool when you're talking about money or Bitcoin or just economics in general, I remember watching the FOMC meeting for the end of year, like in December last year. And I was like so hype about it, eh? Because when you're watching it and you've done all the work to understand the fucking language Jay Powell is saying and you actually understand the words of it's like a different language. So a couple of friends come in, they're like, "What the fuck are you watching, dude?" I'm like, "Dude, this is the craziest shit ever." you take a step back, you're like, "Oh yeah, old man staring at teleprompter, speaking in the most boring English ever. It's fucking criminal how boring they make the monetary fucking fiat network look."
It's actually kind of impressive, because he knows that he can't have anything outside of like a very neutral tone of voice, because anything that he says, like any misuse of a particular adjective, and the market tanks or explodes, right?
Exactly. I know, but man, it's almost a skill what that dude can do, and like the other Fed chairs of the past. Eventually we'll have the last Fed chair, and that'll be fun to see how he holds up. Maybe somebody will come out screaming, "It's the end," and then that'll be hyper Bitcoinization. Who knows? I do. Oh fuck, I lost my question. Hold on, let me think. Okay, we're talking about FOMC. Fucking, I should have wrote it down. Oh, I know what I want to talk about. Okay, so speaking of, you're in Canada, you've doxed yourself that. I do wonder, a lot of your videos you refer to the United States dollar, USD, and I do too. Whenever I'm talking to people, I'm talking about the Bitcoin price in US dollar terms. I've kind of decided, and whenever I'm telling people, I'm like, I've already given up on the Canadian dollar. If anything, if Bitcoin fails, I'll fucking buy US dollars, because the Canadian dollar is basically dead. I'm curious on your thoughts on that. Where you think we hold up against like the Australia, maybe the UK? I feel like it's a race to the bottom. And I'm wondering, just being a Canadian, do you have any faith in our currency, or do you think it's already died a long time ago, and we're just kind of waiting for the US dollar to be the last one, and then we move into Bitcoin? Where do you stand on the Canadian dollar?
I mean, I'm not like a currency expert, but there's two sides to this. If you are going to have something that drives your economy, resources are a really good one. And, you know, we have a ton of resources up here that people are always going to need: fossil fuels, water, timber. But, you know, these things are not explicitly backing the dollar. I think the biggest problem with the currency in Canada is that our GDP is not being driven by the things that drive the strongest economies on earth, which are innovation. We have essentially scared away all innovators in this country. And, you know, we can get into a long conversation about that. But you know, and everyone knows, that as soon as you come up with a business in Canada, you get the hell out and you move to the States. If you are a talented person in arts and entertainment industry, you get the hell out of Canada and you go down to LA. So we scare off innovators, and the top companies in Canada, I think the only one that's a tech company is Shopify. Everything else in the top, you know, 15 companies by market cap in Canada are resource companies that have been there for like 15, 20 years, or maybe longer, and the big banks. So what is our economy? It's a bit of resources. It's a ton of financialization. And then you go a layer deeper, and it's essentially a really propped up real estate market. And so, you know, the economies are very reflective onto the currency itself. The one overhang that we don't have is we don't have a massive military industrial complex that we have to keep satisfied at all times. We don't have, you know, as big of a welfare industrial complex as the US dollar has. So I can't tell you where the Canadian dollar is going in the immediate term, but I think a path to fiscal sustainability for Canadians is a lot easier to achieve in the short term and long term than in America. Like, I think turning that ship around in America is going to be next to impossible, but I think in Canada, it's doable. You know, the same way that Argentina, I think, will make it happen as well. But yeah, in terms of how I think about the US dollar, like, I only think in the US dollar now. In fact, almost every new corporation I've set up, as soon as I fund it with Canadian dollars, it's straight back into American dollars. Because as soon as you need something liquid, or as soon as you start dealing with contracts, you realize your customers, your clients, your employees, they don't want the Canadian dollar. If you send it to them, they're just going to convert it to a home currency. But they will take the American dollar, and they'll either save it or use it themselves, or they'll convert it into whatever their currency is at a later date. So to me, it's just the superior medium of exchange. Obviously not a good store of value, but it beats the Canadian dollar for a medium of exchange. And if you think about the Canadian dollar in that lens too, as medium of exchange, like, to me, it's inferior to the euro at least there's like 20 different countries that accept the euro. But as soon as you leave Canada, our tiny country of like 41 million people, like nobody wants to touch that, not one bit. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's just the whole idea that all these different countries have their own money, I think is going to, you know, generations in the future will look back and think, that's so inefficient. What a stupid idea, you know. So
it's very weird. And like Canada, okay, 41 million people kind of makes sense, but you have these island nations that you can't even spot on a map unless you start zooming in and, you know, finicky around the ocean kind of map exploring. Islands with like 50,000 people and they have their own currency. And sometimes it's just pegged to another one. Like, you know, there's a bunch of islands around Australia that just, you know, have like a, almost like a stable coin peg to the Australian dollar. But then there's other really small countries that have their own sovereign currencies and central banks, and they have like 100,000 people. And you got to just question, like, why? Like, why don't you guys just dollarize, you know?
Yeah, it makes so much more sense. Like, I wouldn't even be mad if Canada just dollarized to the US dollar. I think that would make more sense. Or like you said, the euro. All these things, it's just absurd. I don't know. Maybe we'll see. Okay, this does kind of lead into this question. This is more of a philosophical one for you. I don't know if you've thought much about it, but I want to talk a little bit about CBDCs because this could be the next phase in what happens to the Canadian dollar or the American dollar, these CBDCs. My thing is, like, most Bitcoiners seem to think that they're inevitable. My question to you is, do you think they're inevitable? Because Here's my counterpoint to it. They tried it in Nigeria. And I bring this up because I saw a video that you did of the Nigerian e-naira. Mm-hmm. And it failed almost fucking immediately. Why? Because people didn't want to fucking use it. Why? Because it's shit. Why? Because they just realized it's government-issued currency. And they had already seen their currency fail. So, if the Canadian dollar fails and then the government comes out and says, oh, don't worry, we have the digital loonie now, what self-respecting Canadian person would be like, oh yeah, okay, I'll just try this money? You know, I just think CBDCs there's this idea that there's going to be a fight between CBDCs and Bitcoin, right? But do you think there's going to be a fight, or is it the CBDCs just a failed project off the ground?
I think CBDCs are kind of like a vector, and every country sort of already encapsulates some or all of the features that you would get out of a CBDC. So it really depends where you are. In Canada, everybody who does transactions over like $1,000 uses e-transfer. That is as close to a CBDC as I can think about. Why? Well, those transactions can be made reversible. They are monitored, you know, they say it's, you know, Interact, but all the banks have monitors on these things. They can freeze them at any point. They can cut off your ability across the entire banking system to make e-transfers if you're considered suspicious. Has happened to a couple people that I know. And so at that point, you gotta ask the question, like, what does a digital dollar actually even do differently, right? Oh, maybe we have a wallet on our phone. Great. Well, think of the opposition to that. Number one, that kind of just makes banks obsolete. Like, why do I need a BMO and an RBC if I can get my checking account and maybe even a savings account? Maybe the government starts letting me invest directly into bonds without having to go through another intermediary. That kind of obsoletes banks for a lot of people. I don't think the big banks in Canada are going to love that. I don't think in the United States they'd love it either. So I don't really see it as an immediate threat to North America. There isn't enough of an incentive structure for both the private banks, which are a big part of the banking infrastructure. The people don't really want it. And there's obviously a clear-cut opposition on the right to anything like that as well. You can't just ham that down people's throats without getting a massive change in public opinion about these things. You can force, you know, mandates for shots and stuff like that because you can get public opinion on the side of that, and they did. You can get corporate support on that as well, but I don't think you can do it for CBDCs, not at least in the current state, not with the jargon that's kind of developed around it. Something has to really come and create like a sea change to change people's opinion. Maybe that's a massive financial institution failure, but I don't think that we're going to sleepwalk into CBDCs. There will be a massive shock and then the conversation might shift around it. But in its current state, I just don't think it's in the realm of possibility. And you've even heard central bankers down in the United States say, you know, there's no use for this thing. So.
Yeah, man, I agree with that. I wonder about the major banks. Like you say, they'd obsolete the banks. This might be too personal of a question, so feel free to say, I don't want to talk about that. But for me, I used to be with TD Canada Trust. That was the bank I had since I was like 12 or whatever, and I opened my first bank account. And then I became a Bitcoiner, realized like, oh, I'm paying monthly for this fucking account that so many new... So now my only other bank account that I have, I closed my TD account. Now I just have NeoBank, if you've heard of that. It's some online something. I pay no fees. It's fucking sweet. You know, I get, if I ever get money or if I ever need an e-transfer, it goes there. And then I just send it to whichever given Bitcoin platform I want to use that day. There's quite a few of them in Canada. So yeah, my question to you is like, where do you stand? Because I know that you've recently said that you're getting paid in Bitcoin for a lot of your work. So how often are you interacting with regular banks at this point in your life? Are you almost fully Bitcoinized yourself? Do you still have a legacy bank account? What are your thoughts there?
I think you have to have like at least one fiat on off ramp, because you know, you'll just have people that you can't, you know, Bitcoin to fiat rails, and maybe you don't want to eat the 1% fee a platform like that would charge. So, you know, I do have fiat, but I would say that this year specifically, the need to run things through my bank has decreased a lot. And that has come mostly due to me saying, hey, I'm totally cool with accepting Bitcoin as a form of payment. The other big factor and the reason I've been using Bitcoin a lot more is that Vancouver, where I am in particular, has just aggressively orange-pilled a ton of merchants. And so a lot of the places, and it's not just, I'm not just using them just to be, you know, that nice guy who supports the Bitcoin businesses, but a lot of the businesses that I have been seeking out just so happen to be ones that accept Bitcoin now, like local butchers, certain, you know, Middle Eastern restaurants and stuff where it's just, it's my favorite food, you know, hairdressers that are really actually good at their job, pay them in Bitcoin. So I think for the average individual to use Bitcoin on a day-to-day basis, a lot of the time you'll just be converting it into some sort of fiat equivalent to get stuff done. Like if you want to live on a Bitcoin standard, you're going to be buying a crap load of gift cards at some point. You know, Ben Perrin, BTC Sessions can tell you all about that. But when stuff around you starts accepting Bitcoin, it kind of just becomes a natural thing. And then when you're comfortable accepting it and eating, you know, whatever interim volatility there is with Bitcoin, then it can become a really viable means for everything in life. And then essentially all you're doing is you're becoming a fiat minimalist and you're just, you know, trying to work out as many fiat interactions as you can. Hopefully the day comes, hopefully soon, where I don't need to have any, you know, Canadian on off ramps, for banks. But, you know, right now we're not quite there yet. But I think last year and making those shifts and having all these stores accept Bitcoin has made it really feasible for someone like me, which is great.
Oh yeah, man. We just need more places to accept it as payment and then, you know, just phase out the banks. I really do.
So you want to hear a cool tip I got. So this is from, I think it was from Cole or someone in the Bitcoiners group I'm at, is that sometimes we as Bitcoiners will go into a business and we'll be like, do you accept Bitcoin? And it always kind of sparks kind of an interesting conversation. You'll get people laughing and they'll be like, what, really? Next time, if you've been doing that, you continue doing that, or you can do this instead. You go up and as you're about to pay, you say, I'll pay in Bitcoin. And just changing the phrasing of that normalizes it so much more. And then you can play the, you guys don't accept Bitcoin thing. Like what? You guys don't accept Bitcoin? Like, oh, I know, you know, 80 businesses in Vancouver that do, like you guys should get on that. And that really leaves a much bigger impact than just saying, oh, do you guys accept Bitcoin? So I've started doing that a lot more. I highly encourage everyone to do that. Just normalize paying with Bitcoin and just say, hey, I'm going to pay for this in Bitcoin. And they'll be like, we don't accept Bitcoin. And then the ball's in your court to kind of advance that conversation.
Oh, yeah, man. I like that idea. Yeah, dude, for me, it goes back and forth. I'll have like weeks where I go around every store I go to, hey, do you take Bitcoin? And then it gets kind of tiring after a while. You know, you have the same conversation over and over again. But yeah, next time I get that itch, I'll say, I'll pay in Bitcoin. Because that sounds like a lot of fun. I will absolutely steal that idea from you. That's sweet, dude. So Vancouver specifically, yeah, I'm in Alberta. I'm in Calgary. You should come out to the, what did Ben call it? The Sats market, dude. Just a bunch of Bitcoiners that are selling shit for your Sats. It's fucking sweet.
And yeah, I think I will be coming out for that one. Yeah.
Right on, dude. So yeah, it's sometime in March, and then we're going to do another one in June. I always say, it's like I have no role in this.
How many people turned out for the first one?
Dude, it was pretty big, man. I was pleasantly surprised. It was a decent sized hall. There must have been at least 100 people there. There was,
oh wow,
like what would I say, probably there was 4 rows of tables, and each row probably had 10 tables, so yeah, like 40 tables worth of people selling shit. There was a dude selling beef jerky, chick selling toques, people selling art, books, all sorts of shit, man. Like I didn't have a table. I do renos and stuff, so I just let people know, like, hey, I'll work on your house. You can pay me in sats. I did a backsplash recently. Met a guy there. It was pretty sweet. I've said that story a couple of times on the show now, but it feels good. Like, how good does it feel to get paid in Bitcoin? It's like the best fucking thing in the world. So whenever it happens, I always bring it up a lot because it just makes me happy. Doesn't it feel so good to get paid in Bitcoin?
Yeah. Yeah, I love the instant settlement. I love seeing things denominated in sats. Mm-hmm. You just don't get that with the fiat on-ramp. You know what's really fun, too? I don't know if you use Noster a lot, but like you'll post something and then you'll just see the zaps roll in. It's kind of like probably not good for you dopamine-wise. You know, you get all those like dopamine hits like, oh my God, the sats are just kicking in, they're streaming in. But it's fun. Like there's no other technology that can do that. And explaining that to people, them seeing the novelty of it, I've found has clicked with some people, like, oh my God, like you just post something on Noster and you're just getting 21 sats over and over and over coming in your wallet. That's kind of neat. So
Julian, dude, I've been on a war march or whatever against custodial Lightning wallets. I just dropped an episode recently with Andrew Begin from Blink to talk about custodial Lightning. He kind of swayed me a little bit. But I was super against it. I was fucking wallet of Satoshi hater, just like slamming my fist on the table whenever any Bitcoiner would talk about wallet of Satoshi. I've kind of looked back a little bit, but it just so. And as far as Noster goes, I'm not on Noster yet either. I won't get into that now. I've had that rant a few times too, but we could chat about that off air later if you want. Let's get your opinion on Lightning, dude. So like for me, the fucking thing about Bitcoin is it's money that can't be stolen, and custodial Lightning fucking completely destroys that entire aspect of it. So how do you come to terms with the fact that you're giving up Bitcoin's main most beneficial property in order for ease of use? Is that, that's how I see it. So what are your thoughts, like, just in Lightning in general and then custodial Lightning? Okay. Where do you stand?
Hot take. All Bitcoin can be stolen. It's just a matter of how difficult it is.
Okay.
So you think you're safe with your 12-letter seed phrase. You're safe until someone comes with a wrench and threatens your life, and it depends how much Bitcoin's being locked behind that seed phrase. You know, quantum computing powers that we don't know of maybe could break these things in the future. Who knows, right? I mean, there's a lot of arguments to the quantum computing thing, but who knows, right? Like you can't say there's a 0% chance that any Bitcoin, you know, can be stolen at any point. As soon as you put in a custodial wallet, you're massively increasing the risk of it being stolen. And it depends on your counterparty. So the question you have to ask yourself is like, what's the trade-off? What is the benefit that I'm getting out of it by putting it into a custodial wallet? And you have to weigh that benefit. And I think that that choice is very subjective to the individual. So to you, it might not make any sense to have a custodial wallet because maybe you're not using it frequently enough, and that storing Bitcoin in one of those things presents a big risk over the long term. But for people that are actually spending their Bitcoin and they're just using it almost as like a thing that is a portal, that money comes in, it goes out within the next day or two, what's the risk of that getting rug pulled? Okay, you lose a little bit of like your day's pay. I was in Peru and people are getting paid in Bitcoin for a day of work or for showing up to a class, and then they're spending it the next day. So the only rug pull that's going to happen in that scenario is maybe the person decides to store their long-term wealth, in which case that's a you problem. That's not a custodial wallet problem. And, you know, worst case scenario, they lose a day of money to a custodial wallet provider, you know, suddenly deciding to rug pull someone. But even if the wallets are custodial, they aren't the same as having it on an exchange. So they can't run fractional reserves when people want to spend their Lightning right away, right? There has to be that ability to basically click a button and have it come off. And you can tell right away if any wallets are doing a custodial or a fractional reserve mechanism, because they just won't be able to process transactions immediately. So again, everyone has their different level of risk, but I'll share I'll try and share a quick anecdote about this. We filmed this documentary in Peru, and we're going to these different villages, you know, talking about Bitcoin and how they're using Bitcoin in these real circular economies. And when I say real, I mean that this is all some of these people know. They don't know what the fiat is, you know, really. They just didn't really have any sort of economy going before that. So new economies are popping up. They're using Bitcoin as a store of value, unit of account, and medium of exchange. And it's coming in as fast as it's going out. And I thought, well, custodial wallets, you know, I didn't like them either. Let's try and get some of these people set up on Phoenix. Doesn't work with the fee system. Doesn't work with how hard it is to set up a channel from nothing. Takes a very long time to send a transaction to. If you have crappy internet, try sending Phoenix when you have 2G out in the middle of nowhere to any Lightning wallet. You're going to stand there and you're going to wait 10 minutes, just like you're trying to wait for an on-chain transaction to confirm. That's stupid. Or you can use Blink or CoinOS, and then because the channels are already, you know, pretty much set up, you're going to make that connection in a minute or less. And then you have the whole idea of like, well, let's say I want to onboard someone, you know, their internet might be dead slow. So just downloading Blink, for example, might take an hour, right? Well, that's going to be hard if you need to make something at point of purchase. So then you have custodial wallets like CoinOS, which are just a website. You go in, username, password, you can start using Bitcoin right away. So there's all these things that people don't think about. And honestly, when we talk about Lightning, we have to think about the edge cases and who this stuff is really for. And what I've realized from traveling through Latin America and South America, I don't have the data on this, but I feel pretty confidently that I can say of all the daily active Lightning users in the world, a majority of them are in Latin America and South America, not North America. North Americans, in my opinion, do not make up the majority of people who are using the Bitcoin Lightning Network every single day. And I doubt that's going to change in the next few years. I think it's mostly just going to be a store of value and not a medium exchange. And if we're building these layer twos to be used as medium exchange, we should be focused more on the issues and the challenges of the people actually using them, not the people who just want it to be this thing that they can refer to as a way to use. So that's my hot take.
That's fair, man. I'll give you the Bitcoiner nod of approval in saying that, yes, Bitcoin can be stolen. It's just, holy shit, the likelihood of that happening is pretty low. But I see where you're coming from. I'll let you have that one. It goes up exponentially with custodial Lightning. But that's what I've come to realize is shit's not for me, at least not right now. And I was a big proponent of Phoenix for a long time. And then I tried to onboard somebody with it, realized, oh, this fucking doesn't work at all. Because, yeah, like you said, you have to make an on-chain transaction to start it up anyway. So, yeah, I don't know, man. It's an ongoing thing in the back of my head trying to figure it out. I'm going to have Adam on. We're going to talk about how he's going to trying to implement Lightning to Bitcoin. Well, he's got a couple ideas that episode's coming out. Actually, it might have come out before your episode. We'll see how that happens.
The one thing I've learned from Adam, and he made a really interesting point about this, is there's this tirade on Twitter to kind of just get Coinbase to integrate Lightning, and you know, a couple of people are like, oh, it's not that hard, like Binance did it. The big challenge when you integrate something like Lightning is that when you have routing failures, it creates a massive overhead for all your customers that want to use it. So if I implement Lightning and it ends up having a ton of issues, I could be basically forced to move 2 or 4 or 5 of my customer service agents just to responding to those queries. And you have to, as a business, make the judgment, is it worth it? Are enough people using this? Is this a revenue generating thing? Is this something that the users are demanding? Are we losing users to the exchanges that have enabled Lightning to make that worth it? And some exchanges have done it brilliantly. Like Bitfinex has just created a great infrastructure for Lightning. So it's very easy to take, you know, LN funds off there. But you start rolling it out to, you know, the plebs, no offense to Bitfinex, but, you know, those are very much Bitcoin power users on there. And if you get all these problems, you have to ask yourself, like, is it really worth it as a business to pursue that? And the answer right now for many of them is no. It just requires way more overhead in order to function effectively and without issue. So
it'll be interesting because, yeah, the way Bitcoin Well does it, they make you as the user pay for your transaction fee. You can just choose whichever option you want, and then they send out the batches, or you can get. So yeah, that's a very specific way of doing it. Then Bull Bitcoin, I think they enabled Lightning. I actually haven't tried it myself yet. But one that does come to mind is ShakePay, because ShakePay pays for the transaction fees for all outgoing. I don't know. I'm going to assume you're familiar with ShakePay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So like they pay for the fees going outbound, and they recently upped their limit. Like, you used to be able to withdraw 100,000 sats. Now I think it's 1 million sats. I could be getting the numbers wrong, but regardless, right? Like, if they had a bunch of clients trying to withdraw all their funds in a high fee environment and they're paying for them, they balance it out by with their spreads, right? They, you know, they sell high and buy Bitcoin back from you low, right? So that's what they do. But it could get to a point where it would make more sense for a company that does it in ShakePay's way to enable Lightning so that they don't have to fuck around with fees. But then,
so put yourself in ShakePay's shoes here for a second. Let's just say I want to withdraw Bitcoin to Lightning, and I'm a new user, and some, you know, random Bitcoiner on Twitter told me, oh, you should be using Lightning wallets. Okay. I go and I download Phoenix, and then I make an invoice for Lightning, and I go to ShakePay and I paste that invoice in and I click withdraw. And then, you know, on ShakePay's end, it says routing problem. And then I go to Phoenix and I can't figure out why that's not working. So then what I do is I message a ShakePay customer service provider and I say, hey, my withdrawal is not working. And then they have to troubleshoot me through all of that process. They have to figure out what wallet I'm using. You've just eaten up, like, you know, potentially, you know, hundreds of dollars of someone's time to figure out a problem that, you know, just is not worth it for them in their calculations. I get it. It took me a long time to come around because I used to be one of those people that said, but when you step into the entrepreneurial chair and you kind of see how these businesses operate, it doesn't make sense for a platform like ShakePay to integrate it. Now, when you talk about Bull Bitcoin, they have a very hardcore and tech savvy audience. So they're not going to be bombarded with these very basic questions. You know, their audience kind of understands and their users understand how to use this stuff. And if they're going to be power users, they're not going to be helpless people. They really push to attract these sovereign individuals, but that is just not the audience and the customer base for a lot of these Bitcoin companies. So I get it. The tide will shift eventually. I think LN URLs are kind of the breakthrough on this, because then you don't have to generate invoices for particular amounts, and you can just send it to, you know, emails, and, you know, usually those confirm pretty quickly. But yeah, I think it still doesn't make sense for a lot of companies at this point.
Yeah, we're still early, man. We'll see what still happens. We'll see what happens with, like, there's so much competition between exchanges too, right? Like, we just named 3. I think there's another 4 or 5 or 6 that I can name in Canada alone. So we'll see who wins out and what customers actually appreciate given what they're looking for from an exchange. So it'll be interesting to see that story develop. Probably whatever Quadriga was doing. Don't do that and you'll stay in business. Dude, I need to switch gears here a little bit back to your content creation. I need to compliment you on your superb scripting skills. I don't know how the fuck you do it, dude. I pulled one thing. I want to ask you, how do you come up with the ideas for your shorts? How much time and effort do you put in towards making that script so concise? I'm going to read this one line that I was like, wow, that's the most beautiful way to say that ever. You said, Value is subject to the individual. Bitcoin, along with all forms of money, derives subjective value from the soundness of its properties. And I was like, damn, I've been trying to explain that for fucking years. And he just said it in, you know, 12 words or whatever. It's unreal. So how much effort do you put into making your videos concise, easily understandable by the general public? How much effort do you put into thinking through what message you're trying to get across? Or do you just spitball ideas out there? Because it seems like you're putting in a lot of work. Or does that just come to you naturally?
It's taken a while. Like, I think you can go back to my first shorts, and I think anyone can see that the first attempts at them were just not as good, and they weren't as concise, and they just didn't feel done. With everything that you do, you know, regularly, you build a routine around it. And so my mission was to kind of make these. At first I was putting out one a week, and then I thought, okay, I got to put out two a week. But the only way to do that is to sort of routine it as much as possible. And when your job is to come up with fresh ideas all the time, it gets daunting. So, you know, at that pace, that's like 8 to 9 fresh ideas a month. A lot of it comes from Twitter. I've seen some excellent Twitter threads, and I've just said, hey, I think there's a way to do this visually. A lot of it has come from, I will just, you know, come up with a formula for something. So one of the types of videos I make, I don't classify them, but we'll just call them FUD busting. Like, I'll just take a one line objection to Bitcoin, and I'll just make the next 60 seconds. I'll say that line at the beginning of the video. I'll say like, oh, Bitcoin's bad for the environment. And then I'll say wrong. And then now I have 150 words at my speaking pace to debunk that. And so that kind of sets in motion the writing process, is you sort of like, I guess, like a chatbot. You come up with prompts for yourself. And I like to call them hooks as well. So the way that I try and design my shorts is that whatever I'm saying in the first sentence, it's got to grab people's attention. It's either got to be a kind of an interesting rhetorical question. Maybe it's a TikTok video of someone asking a question. I've done a couple of those. Maybe it's just like a really bold, outlandish claim. But I have to come up with those central ideas, and then the next, you know, bunch of words kind of follow that. It's essentially like writing a blog, because you have like your introduction claim, you have your thesis, and then you have kind of your conclusion, which is the last sentence. But instead of everything being like body paragraph, conclusion, you have one sentence to kind of accomplish all those key points in a convincing essay. And not all the shorts are like that. You know, I've tried to not be super rigid with it, because I think that you have to kind of approach things with a bit of humor. You got to leave room for memes and stuff like that in there. But yeah, I've essentially refined it down to a process. And in fact, now I'm trying to scale it up, and I'm trying to find other writers who can kind of like, I can give this template to, and then they can just inject their own unique ideas and then kind of write them in the style that's needed to kind of get something of value out there in 60 seconds. And I'm hiring actually writers for this right now. And I basically, the candidates that had, you know, good resumes, I said, hey, if you're really interested in this position, here's a assignment. Here's how I write my scripts. I broke down every single step. Pick a subject, or here's like 5 or 6 that I came up with one-liners, and make a script around it. And then I'll see if, you know, you get it, and I'll give you revisions, and I'll see if it works. And I've gotten some pretty good submissions, but yeah, it's sort of hard. That's the hardest part of the process. But I would say on average, I spend about an hour writing each kind of 60 second short. They're 170 words tops, maybe 175 if there's not a ton of syllables. I'll film chunks of them at a time. So I'll try and write 4 or 5. I'll shoot 4 or 5. It'll be me in front of my camera in my office, just going nuts sometimes. And then I will send them off to an editing team that I have that kind of just puts them together really nicely. And, you know, I'll tweak them and make them look pretty. But the average amount of time it takes to get, let's just say, one short from beginning to end, from writing to finished edited product, is about 3 to 4 hours. So if I was making them every single day, I could maybe crank out 2 a day. But what I try and do is I try and get big lots of them done ahead of time. And I try and pick evergreen topics so that, you know, I can just get those out of the way and then focus on the longer form content.
Oh yeah, man. Well, it's definitely working. You're getting some good signal out there. I appreciate it. I like the conciseness. I like your videos. I'm going to, you know, as Bitcoiners, I talked to people, and you can't send the fucking Sailor series to everyone. Like, here's 12 hours of somebody. And yeah, finding your videos, I'm like, let's see how this works. So that's what I'm going to start doing now. It's like, check out this. Here, this guy explains what money is in fucking 90 seconds. It's pretty sweet. So yeah, I definitely appreciate that. Is there anything
what else I really you love? Yeah. What I really love about the short form content is, like when you do podcasts, when you do these big written essays and submissions to Bitcoin Magazine, these things are very time intensive. And so it's like the more time you invest into those bigger projects, maybe long form documentaries too, the more that you demand of it as an outcome. Like if you put in hundreds of hours into a documentary and you put it out into the world and the algorithm just doesn't care for it, you feel crushed. And I've been on the receiving end of that. I've really put a ton of work into long form things and I just haven't found an audience for them. But the nice thing with the short form stuff is you're investing 4 hours of your time and you're learning little by little with every submission. Not every single one of them is going to bang, but you'll get some rewarding, you know, kind of piece of feedback from it. Maybe you did one thing right. Maybe it does go viral. Maybe you get a bunch of hate comments. Maybe one video, you know, somebody tells you, hey, you got your facts wrong. You'll always get at least like one piece of value out of it. And that's why I highly encourage people to just get on that creation train, not to feel like they have to keep up with the treadmill of being a creator, because there is a bit of that. You know, sometimes I feel like if I only put out one of these every 2 weeks, you know, I'd go nowhere. But I do it primarily to get that real flywheel of feedback. And so doing these every 2 weeks or twice a week, it's number one, really helped me find my voice in terms of, well, what are people the most responsive to? What are the topics that people are the most interested in that I talk about? I can hone in on those. And then, you know, what are the videos that I make that people really connect with? I didn't really try and make a funny video until middle of last year. And it was this video of this girl, and she's like, if you had 24 hours with me, you know, what would we do? And I thought, oh, I should just rattle on a whole bunch of like Bitcoin maxi isms. And I put that out in the world and it blew up instantly. It was like my top video. And I realized, wow, you know, why is this working? Well, number one, it's sort of funny, so it's an easy share. But number two, I think it's just that energy that I brought to it is just something that I think is a little bit unique for Bitcoin content creation. And so I took those two pieces of feedback and I've just tried to integrate it, and I've done it over and over again. And the videos that have applied those to always seem to do the best. And so you keep doing stuff like that, you get that iterative feedback and you end up producing your best work over time. So yeah.
Hell yeah, man. That's the video that I first saw of you. I was crying laughing. What would you do? And I was showing it to everybody. This guy fucking gets it. Listen to what he's telling you to do.
Yeah.
It was so good, man. Okay. Was there anything you wanted to talk about the future of what you got coming up in the future for your channel, for your content creation, anything else that you want to promote that you got going on?
Yeah. So, I don't know when this podcast is going live, but I'll drop some juicy deets. Part of the struggle of being a content creator, besides trying to make a living on it, is it gets very lonely. There isn't necessarily a community around you from the get-go. And if you're lucky, you can make people, you know, follow you and you know, support what you're doing. But ultimately, the creation process, if you're talking to a camera, recording a podcast, can be very, very lonely. And so I found that, and you know, luckily I've found other like-minded individuals and we can share stories about content creation and learn from one another. But my big resolution for 2024 was I want to find more people to collaborate with and to build something with and to go on this journey with me who are like-minded, who like being in front of camera and feel that they can deliver, you know, Bitcoin signal in a collaborative way. And I've always been such a lone wolf. I was that kid in school who, you know, just did the school, you know, project or assignment by himself, didn't like to work with other people. And I said, that's definitely one of my like weak points as a person is I'm just not super collaborative. I just, you know, they say, if you want to get a job done, do it yourself. And I just think at this point in my life, I was kind of sick of doing that. And I have to change, I think, in order to be a better person, but also be a better creator. So The big thing that is happening over the next few days, weeks, whenever this video comes out, is I am teaming up with two other creators to essentially make what I do a lot more frequent and have a lot more different hosts and perspectives, but still carry that overall theme and authenticity and voice of my content through it. So the company, we're still working on the name, but we're pretty sure it's going to be called Get Based. Get Based TV, Get Based Productions, but it'll just be known as Get Based. And I'm going to be joined by Isabella Santos, who hosts a show on Bitcoin Magazine. She also traveled to Peru with me to do a documentary. And I'm also going to be joined by Adam O'Brien, who runs Bitcoin Well, who, if you don't know, also is just fantastic at content creation. And we have a whole host of documentaries, shows, informative video essays, social experiments, really kind of crazy and unique content that we're working on and bringing to the Bitcoin space. It's a huge venture for all of us. We've all sacrificed and sold Bitcoin to make it happen. But I think it's something that the space needs. I think that we need to have a voice that sort of pierces through the Bitcoin echo chamber and starts really hitting the mainstream a lot more. I think Bitcoiners are very, very interesting people, and normies don't spend enough time with us. We just like to spend time with each other because we think that we get it. And I think that media in this space can't go on like that forever. I think something has to change. I think we have to start collaborating with other people a lot more. And the whole point of the media agency for us is that we are going to do that. We're going to break out. We're going to aim to have videos that get millions of views, like some of mine already have, and really make an impact in the world and bring the idea of like Bitcoin culture and Bitcoin ethos to a much wider audience than what currently exists out there in the podcast space or in the book space or in the education space. So yeah, that's sort of the exciting thing. We'll see how it goes. We'll see how much Bitcoin I burn through before you know, the dreams get reached. But it's exciting because it's something that I've wanted to do for a very long time, and I finally kind of found the team to make it happen. So yeah, look forward to that stuff.
Hell yeah, man. Big fan of Adam. Isabella, I don't know her last name, but I've seen her stuff as well. She does good work in the space, man. So I'm excited to see what you guys put together. I think it'll be great. I hope the best for you, because not to be negative, dude, but yeah, like this is the weird thing about creating content in Bitcoin. It, you know, we do really just talk to each other and pat each other on the back. I think, not that I'm a huge fan of Breedlove, but he's gone out and he's kind of tried to talk to other non-Bitcoiner people. Even like for me, where one of my first Bitcoin things I listened to was, what's his fucking name? Anthony Pompliano went on a comedy podcast. And so if it wasn't for him going on that show, I wouldn't have found Bitcoin. So I appreciate that. I think that's a important thing. If your goal is to spread Bitcoin awareness, to stop just talking to other Bitcoiners like what I do on this show. I'm going to keep doing what I'm doing because I like doing, but hey, I'll leave.
It's not a problem though to create. Like, I actually am not one of those people that think there are too many Bitcoin podcasts. I think if you have a voice and you have something to contribute and you love doing it, just do it. Don't let anyone else, you know, shame you out of it. What I feel though is that the way that I've learned is through comedy and through experimentation and through these really weird mediums. And I just don't see enough of that out there. And it's my belief that there's a lot of other people like me out there who want to learn about X, Y, or Z, but the presenters out there delivering it, and then the way that a topic is unraveled or talked about, there just aren't the creators to match that. But I've seen evidence from all these other video journalists on a myriad of other topics that have made something that would otherwise seem very trivial and weird and have turned it into like a multi, you know, million view hit and really changed the minds of people. One of my favorite creators is Johnny Harris, and his top video, I think it's got like 9 million views, is why are the McDonald's ice cream machines always out of order? It's a question that everyone's always had, but no one's actually gone out and made a video about it. And I think a lot of people have those questions about Bitcoin. They have these questions about money and the way that society works and all these things. And just nobody has actually tackled it with a really interesting piece of media and a vision to explain it to them. And I think that is the opportunity with what we're doing.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, Johnny Harris. I watch his videos every now and again. That guy.
If there's 10 million people that want the answer to why the ice cream machines at McDonald's are broken, there are 20 to 100 million people who want to learn about why Bitcoin's still a thing, you know, 15 years later.
Hell yeah, man. That's awesome. Yeah, no, absolutely. I like that guy. He's a weird guy. But his videos are intriguing. I'll give you that much. That's for sure. Okay, I got one more question for you, which I hope it doesn't fall flat on its face. But I got to know, you've been the man on the street with the fucking sign that says, "What is Bitcoin?" And you're holding the cardboard sign. Can you recall any behind the scenes things that happened that you couldn't put on air because you really pissed somebody off or something bad happened? Was there anything behind the scenes of that particular video that went wrong?
Let me think about that.
I know it was a little while back.
That's the Shamory video where I was just asking people like, what is money and Bitcoin and all that. No, not really. I mean, no,
that's good then.
Everyone I was asking was Canadian. I will say, everyone's just polite here. They're not going to confront you. I will say one of the interesting experiences I had was, when we were in Peru, Isabella and, Valley, who was part of our team filming this documentary about Motive, this nonprofit, we went into some stores and they were, you know, attempting to orange pill people in Spanish. And I got to kind of just sit there and look at the faces. I didn't have to record with my camera. I just kind of got to be an audience to this. And it made me realize a lot about how we talk about Bitcoin to people. You go off, you know, you just go off on Bitcoin's this and that, and you just tirade like you're a guest on a podcast, and you just expect this other people on the other end of it to listen to you and then, you know, pick up something. But it's a lot. Like when you start breaking down inflation, deflation, money printing, all these different concepts, and you're just stringing them all together in one rant, which I think a lot of us make, no matter how coherent of speakers we are, it's not all going to get absorbed. And so what I think that we need to do more of, especially as we go and we try and talk about Bitcoin with other people, is we have to have more of a volley going on rather than like a one-way information overload. That's what the videos and podcasts and courses are for. But when we talk to Bitcoin in person with people, we should be more open to asking them questions about what they think money is and try and keep an even pace of conversation going rather than spam them with all the reasons that Bitcoin is the best. I think that is going to be a lot more conducive to getting more people IRL orange pilled. And kind of seeing it firsthand and seeing how kind of ineffective just telling them about all the amazing properties of Bitcoin are, it just made me realize like we need to be less sales pitchy about it in person and more kind of, I guess, reactive and adaptive to whatever our audience is.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I've definitely been that dude that would go on 2-hour rants to somebody explaining why Bitcoin is going to fix all their problems, and it does not work. Sometimes you got to stop and listen. Completely agree. All right, man. Is there anything else you wanted to touch on that we didn't talk about tonight?
No, man. Thanks for having me on the show. Really love what you're doing with all this. I'm going through some of the other episodes, and it's so... I don't know. Have you been a guest on podcasts before?
I've done a couple. I did Discovering Bitcoin, which I know you were on. I like that guy a lot. He's good. Mm-hmm. I've done High Hash Rate. Have you know those guys?
No, I don't.
Actually. Okay, check them out. They make some good shows. But yeah, absolutely.
What do you find of like, if you can be as objective as possible, like what do you enjoy more, being a guest or being a host?
Oh man, don't make me answer that on my own show. Dude, being a guest.
Yeah, there's one right answer when it's your own show. But
I love being a host of my... No, dude, like, I mean, being a host is fun because I get to just... I spitball out DMs and be like, hey, do you want to come on my show just to chat? I've had amazing opportunities to talk with some unbelievable, extremely intelligent people. And it's been a blast just to pick their brains. Like, even just like people like you... Not to say just people like you, but like people that put a lot of thought into content creation or people that put a lot of thought into, you know, their given subject. It's so fun to get to ask those questions to see where they're at. But being a guest, on the other hand, is it's laid back, right? You just get to kind of chill, say your own piece, answer questions. And there's a lot less stress when you're a guest, I guess, than when you're a host. I'm sure you kind of feel that too, right? When you're producing a show, you got to put the questions together. You got to have interesting questions. Hopefully people want to answer. And then when you're a guest, it's way more chill. Mm-hmm. I think it's just more chill. Would you agree?
I'm on the same boat. It is stressful being a host sometimes. And I think it just depends on how you approach it. And the thing that I really want to crack the, call it mystery of, is how you have certain hosts that don't really come in that prepared and they still have great shows and great conversation flow. Because I find that if I don't have all my questions in a line prepared, I'm just nervous. Like, I'm like, I don't know where this is going to go. I don't want to feel that I'm wasting the audience's time with chit chat. But you get people like Rogan. And I think, you know, the reason that hosts like Peter McCormack are so good at this is that they do a little bit of prep. They know their guests a little bit of ahead of time, but they really let those conversations naturally flow without a ton of prep work and sticking to a script. And I'd like to crack that code at some point. I love to interview, you know, McCormack or one of these hosts that does not prep a bunch and just see if it's just something that is just like natural for them, or if they had to kind of get to that state where they can just let things flow and not, you know, over prepare.
Well, let me ask you then, did this feel like I was extremely prepared? I feel like we flowed pretty good. I'll send you my notes.
but I think as a host, don't you feel like a little self-conscious sometimes? Like, is it like too scripted? Is it not scripted enough? Like, I find as a host, I'm always thinking about that as I'm hosting. Did I really get to everything I wanted to get to? So to me, that's like the stress never really leaves, you know, whether I've prepped or not. So,
I mean, I've come to realize that you'll never get all the questions in that you have. So I'll just throw down a bunch of notes of things that I want to talk about. Like even on yours, you know, I got another page full of shit that we could have talked about, but we're already running on, you know, we've already gone over an hour. It's insane how quick time flies on a podcast. And then I just say, if you want to come back and we can chat about other shit, we can do that. So I wouldn't say I have low expectations, but it's more just you want to talk about the things that are interesting to you at the time. Like, I had no plans on asking you about lightning, but we chatted about lightning for a bit. You know, it's just what comes up and what comes, yeah, natural, like you say. And as far as stress goes, I used to be stressed, but dude, I'm in a different place than you. I wanted to be like super famous on the internet for a minute. That's not really my goal anymore. So I don't see it that way. For me, it's just really, I want to have a bunch of podcasts so that when people say, oh, you got so lucky, like, fuck you, I got lucky. Here's 300 hours of shit I recorded trying to explain this shit to people. This is I should probably edit that out, but just for my own, you know, just for my own curiosity's sake. There's no stress. And the other thing is, talking to Bitcoiners is the most chill fucking thing in the world. Every Bitcoiner I've ever talked to is the nicest, coolest, most relaxed, most easy to talk to, not judgmental, just, you know, laid back conversations. It's really nice. So like before, you probably edit this part out, but before I started making my Bitcoin podcast, I did a video games podcast where I tried to do that, and it was a lot more scripted. And I used to be a streamer on Twitch, and I did that, and I was trying to get, you know, quote unquote, big content creation. I made a few YouTube videos. So I know what the grind is, man. And I respect you for doing it. Like, the grind is fucking hard when you're trying to be a YouTuber, be a content creator. You can't fuck around. You got to put in the work, and you get out of it what you put into it. So I'm glad to see that you're putting in the work, that you've put in thought to what you want to do, that you're actually, you know, you're out there, you're getting bigger, you're seeing what works, what doesn't work, and you're spreading good fucking signal. Like, at the end of the day, that's the most important thing, is what is the message that you're trying to spread and why are you trying to spread it? So there's a lot of content creators that are just there to be a person on the internet and hope that they fucking get some ad revenue and that's going to be their, you know, that's going to be their life. It's like, that doesn't work. Have a message, have a reason for what you're doing, and enjoy what you do, right? Like, exactly. if you're not enjoying it, you're fucked. And if you don't have a reason for it, you're fucked. So I think you're checking off every box of the right way to do it. And I only hope the best for you, man. So yeah, keep doing what you're doing. You're fucking crushing it. I guess with that, you should let the audience, anybody listening, know where to find you on Twitter, Noster, if you want, your YouTube channel. Yeah, chill all your stuff, dude.
Chill all my shit. Yeah, sure thing. You can find me on Twitter as Kinetic Finance. I got the blue check. There's been some imposters lately. Instagram, TikTok, Kinetic Finance. If it's a guy making a bunch of shorts and he's got a reasonable follower count, it's me. I think you probably know dealing with imposters, man. You know what the craziest thing is now is Twitter makes you upload a piece of ID. Even though you're using like a pseudonym, they're like, oh, we need to make sure it's really you. We got to upload ID. So don't get me into that. That's a whole other conversation. But yeah, Kinetic Finance, YouTube, Twitter, everywhere where you can watch videos, I will be. And yeah, stay in touch because there's going to be a name change and some cool people joining me very soon.
Right on, man. We're all looking forward to it. It's going to be good stuff. Oh, dude, I got time. One last question. Well, you just said you're changing your name, but why did you call it Kinetic Finance? What was the idea behind that name?
I think it kind of self-explains a little bit, like just interesting, dynamic finance. It was going to be some adjective about teaching finance. Used to be called Kinetic Crypto, and then I stopped talking about shit coins. And my video production agency was called Kinetic Cuts because most video companies are like X agency or X studios or X productions, and I didn't want to have that as sort of like the ender. So I thought cuts would be cool. What word goes cool with cuts? Kinetic came to mind. So yeah, it's been kind of just building off of that, but it's going to be called Get Based. That's the new one.
That's such a fucking good name, dude. That's sick. All right. Okay. Well, if you made it this far, we appreciate you listening. If you want to support the show, but like I always say, the best thing to do is just share it with a friend. If you got any value out of it, let people know that you enjoyed the show and share it around. What else should they do, Julian? What do you say to do things for people? Like, comment, and subscribe? I never say that shit. Do you think it works? Do you think saying like, comment, and subscribe works?
I think so. I think people have built empires on it. Yeah. Look at Mr. Beast. He's doing it every video. So I don't know. I think it works.
All right. Maybe
yeah, I should like, comment, it. Subscribe, zap, upvote, all the things.
All the things. All right. With that, Julian, thanks again. We appreciate you, listener. Oh, fuck. Boosts. I forgot to read them once again. Someday I'll read the boosts. It's all right. And always, if ever, you know, it's the what you got to do. What do you have to do right now? The most important thing you can do right now is buy as much Bitcoin as you can before the end of the world. All right. Till next time. Peace.
Peace.